So next we're going to be hearing a talk, or actually parts of a talk by David Eby, who's the executive director of the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, talking about the upcoming 2010 Olympics in Vancouver that have been a big issue. Black Mask has been reporting on them quite a bit in terms of protests that are happening kind of under the banner of no Olympics on stolen native land. People here in Winnipeg may have seen stickers about this, as well as posters. There was at least one protest here against the spirit train that was coming across the country. And so the talk he gave was a talk to law students. So some of the language in the initial talk was a bit legalistic, but with the clips we picked, I think are not so much so and should be pretty understandable and are quite interesting as well. So as far as background, there's huge protests that are expected against the Olympics this coming kind of February of 2010. First Nations groups, anti-poverty folks, and all kinds of people are really converging around this event. And the city of Vancouver has been putting in place bylaws recently that come into effect right before the Olympics are set to start, that are limiting things like free speech, abilities to protest in all kinds of different ways that people suspect are not even constitutional under Canada's own laws. But the expectation is that they're trying to rush these bylaws in and not give people time enough to challenge them. And by the time they're challenged, the Olympics will be over. So they'll have these kind of illegal laws in place. The talk he's giving is interesting. It touches on the issues of free speech. It also touches on agent provocateur and ceaseless interference, which has been a big issue. Indigenous activist Gord Hill a couple days ago put out a bulletin, I think it was on dominionpaper.ca, talking about CSIS agents visiting his house, and he talked about Indigenous sovereignty and all kinds of issues around that and Canadian law. But he also talked about holding, that we still need to hold the Canadian government accountable to even its own laws. Not that that's necessarily sufficient, but that's an important part of it. So in that context, this talk by David Eby is really important because he lays out what the Canadian law is. The British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, as he talks about at the start, is a liberal organization in kind of the original John Stuart Mill sense that maybe conflicts with a lot of the politics of this show and people who listen to this show, but it's interesting nonetheless. They're going to be talking about organizations like VANOC, which is the Vancouver Olympics Committee, the NOC, which is the National Olympics Committee. And he starts off by talking about his group, the BC Civil Liberties Association, and what that group is. We want to thank MediaCoop.ca and Don Paley specifically for recording this material and making it available. And if you're interested in more information on the BC Civil Liberties Association, you can visit their site at bccla.org. They're organizing a number of interesting initiatives to try to counter a lot of this Olympic stuff, including training legal observers to observe government security force interactions and trying to limit the role that CSIS agent provocateurs might be able to play. So have a look at that. It's really interesting.
Our organization is about 50 years old, or 45 years old. We were formed in the 60s. And one of the continuing and most important mandates of the organization is the free speech issue. The organization is founded on the largely small liberal philosophies of John Stuart Mill, with some modifications to bring in substantive equality issues of various forms. But at its heart, the organization believes that the only way that we can address the issues that are facing us is to have full and frank discussion about issues, and not to try to restrict speech around issues, because by restricting speech, what you do is you effectively give those ideas more currency than they necessarily deserve. And not only that, you cause people to, instead of talking about issues, resort to activities like terrorism to get their ideas across because they don't have a space to express those ideas. So at its core, free speech and protecting free speech in our minds and our organization's philosophy is actually a security-enhancing idea. By promoting free speech and protecting free speech, you're actually protecting everyone's security and discouraging terrorist activity, discouraging activity that would otherwise affect people's safety. Free speech has sort of an interesting history with the Olympics. There are a number of high-profile events related to free speech. Most recently in Beijing, discussions around the protest pens in Beijing and how people had to register to protest and how the protest pens ended up sitting empty when no one got approved to protest and those who applied were arrested. But if you go further back, athletes, for example, given the black power sign, the upraised fist when receiving medals were subject to censure. And there was a discussion about how do we, within the Olympic movement, about how do we keep the Olympic movement separate from political propaganda, how do we keep it separate from commercial influence. They came up with something called the Olympic Charter. Now, the Olympic Charter is a document that they have adopted for themselves. But one of the provisions says that all the venues, the Olympics themselves, should be free from commercial propaganda, religious propaganda, and any indicators that that the Olympics is somehow politically in favor or opposed to one particular political system or another. This is the broad philosophy of the Olympic movement compared to the broad philosophy of the Civil Liberties Association and generally the Civil Liberties philosophy. So you can see that we might not agree on everything. Back in 2003, when Vancouver was awarded the Olympic Games, the city was required to sign a contract with the International Olympic Committee. Now, the Olympics are awarded specifically to cities. They're not given to private actors. They're given to government actors, and this will be important later on in our discussion about whether or not the charter applies. But when the Olympic Games were awarded to Vancouver, there was a host city agreement. And in that agreement was clause number 47 that gives effect to section 51 of the Olympic Charter, which is the city, the NOC is the National Olympic Committee. So there's a National Olympic Committee that fields an Olympic team of athletes every year for Canada. That's the NOC. And the OCOG, which is the Olympic Organizing Committee, initially the bid committee, and then later on VANOC, the organizing committee. All of those three signed this contract and made this promise to the International Olympic Committee. The International Olympic Committee is a separate organization located in Geneva, Switzerland, that owns all of the copyright and trademarks over the Olympic marks, the Olympic Games, and they are a private corporation there. So you see in this clause, the city promises that the Olympic Charter provisions relating to propaganda and advertising will be strictly observed. And most importantly, this clause right here, the city, the NOC, and the OCOG shall ensure that no propaganda or advertising is placed within the Olympic venues or outside the Olympic venues in such a manner so as to be within the view of the television cameras covering the sports of the games or of the spectators watching the sports of the games. The question, there are a couple questions, you probably all are at various stages of having done contract law or you're in contract law. There are a couple questions about the enforceability of this contract. First is the jurisdiction of the city to be able to enter a contract that essentially guarantees that in public space outside Olympic venues that there will be no religious or political propaganda. Is the city actually able to enter into a contract like that? Now, the city certainly purported to. This contract was signed by the mayor of the city of Vancouver at the time, Larry Campbell. And it is this contract that the city has both formally and informally pointed to as the reason for passing the bylaws that I'm going to talk about shortly. But the first question is, does the city have the jurisdiction to sign it? The second is, would the courts actually give effect to this contract? Or would they, for public policy reasons, like when you're looking at contracts that essentially that have racist provisions, for example, public policy reasons that the court would not give effect to those contracts? Here, a contract that ostensibly restricts public free expression outside of Olympic venues. Would a court look at this if the city failed to prevent people from picketing outside the venues? Would a court hold the city liable for signing the contract and failing, breaching the contract for any damages that would flow to VANOC as a result of the breach? And the answer, I think, in both cases is likely no. But the city decided that they would give effect to this contract that was signed actually not by the previous administration, but the administration before that, feeling that it bound the city to prevent Olympic propaganda or prevent religious and political propaganda from being inside and outside of Olympic venues. And to give effect to that contract in July of this year, July 23rd, I remember because it was 2 days after my birthday and I was out of town for the introduction of this particular piece of exciting legislation. This is the 2010 Olympic and Paralympic Winter Games bylaw, and in their public communications, the city called this the Olympic Relaxation Bylaw. This is going to relax the rules around the city, the very strict rules of no fun Vancouver, let the bars stay open later, let garbage delivery be picked up later, that we were actually going to be relaxing the rules around the Olympics related to pretty much all of the city's operations. Now, the truth of the matter was actually quite the opposite, that there was a restriction on how citizens could express themselves in a number of very important areas within the city. These are the most troubling provisions, in my opinion, in the games bylaw. And they focus on how you may express yourself in an area that I counted to be about 40 square city blocks downtown. And we'll look at a couple of the perimeters so you get a sense of what's involved. But the bylaw starts out by defining what a celebratory sign is. And this is my favorite because everyone gets a kick out of this. A celebratory sign is a sign that celebrates the 2010 Winter Games and creates or enhances a festive environment and atmosphere for the 2010 Winter Games. So that's a celebratory sign. And it's celebratory signs that are expressly permitted within the bylaws. Now, I don't know if I reproduce the particular section on the, 8 sub C here. The bylaw expressly restricts all signs except for signs that are pre-existing. Any sign on a street that is a celebratory sign, so if you've got a celebratory sign, you're all right, or a wayfaring sign that's authorized by VANOC or the city. Now, there's a sort of statutory interpretation issue of whether it's celebratory signs authorized by VANOC or the city, or it's celebratory signs simpliciter. That is, if you don't have an authorization from the city, you can just hold up your celebratory sign. But either way, it's unconstitutional because it purports to limit the ability of the city to authorize signs that are not celebratory in the best case scenario. In the worst case scenario, it says that you can hold celebratory signs with or without authorization of the city, but you're not allowed to hold any other signs in these areas that are set out by the bylaw. In addition to that provision, there is also a prohibition on, if you look at 4B sub B, a prohibition on causing any disturbance that could interfere with the enjoyment of entertainment on city land by other persons. Now, if you've done criminal law, you know about breach of the peace. That already exists on lawful assemblies. There are criminal provisions against causing or participating in a riot. So it's not clear about what this provision of causing a disturbance or nuisance adds to the existing breach of the peace provisions. But one would assume that there was some kind of a gap that breach of the peace didn't address that the city's trying to address through this provision. So if you put these two together, that you're not allowed anything except for a sign that's celebratory, and you're also not allowed to create a disturbance that interferes with other people's enjoyment of Olympic activity, you've prohibited all of the activities associated with traditional protests. So if you picture someone picketing, they've got a sign, they're chanting, they're singing songs. You know, it's sort of the stereotypical protest. If you picture a protest in your mind, those are the activities associated with protests. And here the bylaws themselves restrict the ability of people to do that. Not only that, in the bottom, sub 7 here, you're not allowed to hand out any leaflets or distribute any advertising material during the games, unless you're an official Olympic sponsor and it's sanctioned by the IOC and by the city. So all of the independent businesses that are on Robson Street, on Granville Street, Hastings, and we'll go through the list of the streets, but it's significant, will not be able to say, hey, we've got a pizza special on today, Olympic tourists, come on in. Because independent businesses do not count. The only businesses that count are the Olympic sponsors and the wishes of the IOC to protect those Olympic sponsors. So we'll have a look at the perimeters where the bylaw purports to extend its authority. And you need to understand that there's a provision in the bylaw that says that these perimeters can be expanded without notice by the city engineer, and that the rules within the perimeters can be changed without notice by the city manager. It doesn't have to go to council. The only notice that's required is a posting at the outside of the perimeter that sets out the new rule. So I'm not sure quite where they put the postings over this huge area, but presumably on the telephone poles, I don't know. But it's somewhere around here there would be postings that say there's a new rule, here's what the new rule is, and the perimeters could be expanded at any time. So you've got sites traditionally associated and very closely associated with free expression, the library within the perimeter. You also have a significant number of residential areas that overlook Olympic venues. And in addition, the whole of the seawall and all of the sort of broad assembly areas where you could theoretically assemble to protest. There are a number of vacant lots through here and areas where people could theoretically protest. So these perimeters where these new rules apply are very broad, and the rules themselves are completely alterable by the city manager without notice. So that was pretty bad. We saw the bylaw, we saw the perimeters, it was pretty heavy-handed stuff. And then it got worse. Last week, the Miscellaneous Statutes Amendment Act was introduced at the provincial legislature. And this is a very interesting piece of provincial legislation in that it responds to a request from the City of Vancouver for further powers. The city asked for powers to increase the fines related to illegal signs from $2,000 a day to $10,000 a day, and to shorten the notice periods. Traditionally, if you have an illegal sign in Vancouver, the city needs 2 weeks' notice to come into your place and remove it. So they post the notice, remove your illegal sign. 2 weeks later, a city worker can show up at your house, go on your property, remove the sign. They wanted to shorten that notice period. They also wanted to shorten the notice period for removing graffiti from your house from 2 weeks to zero. They want to be able to go onto your property and remove graffiti without any notice period to you saying, hi, we're coming onto your property and we're going to remove that graffiti. The specific wording of it says that within the time period of the Olympic Games, so there's not even an idea that more broadly this power is needed, that it's addressing a gap in existing city powers. This change is only in place for the Olympic period, with the exception of the increase in the fines. The shortening of the notice periods is going to be in place from January until March 2010. So subject to this section, a person authorized by council of a specified municipality, there are three specified municipalities, Vancouver, Richmond, and Whistler. The unifying theme between those three is, of course, they're all Olympic cities. Has the authority to enter on property and to enter into property without the consent of the owner or occupier for the purpose of enforcing the specified municipality's bylaws in relation to signs. But don't worry, they're not allowed to just barge onto your property. They may only exercise the authority at reasonable times and in a reasonable manner. And they also must take reasonable steps to advise the owner or occupier before entering your property. They need to give you 24 hours written notice of the entry into your property and the reasons for it. And once they're on your property, they can remove, cover, or alter a sign that's in contravention of the municipality's bylaws. When you put this together with the bylaws that are already put in place by the City of Vancouver, you have a situation where, even if it's only theoretical, a system of powers has been created within municipal workers to enter into private property within perimeters that are defined in the bylaws that we've looked at that include hundreds, if not thousands, of condominium units to remove signs from the windows of the interiors of the houses of people that live there. Also to remove signs from the property, the private property of businesses or any other land that people have that overlooks or is within these perimeters that overlooks venues. In addition, graffiti, if there's graffiti on the side of your house, the city worker can enter without notice and remove it at cost to you. In terms of accountability, Vanhock issued this community engagement considerations brochure to all the places along the torch route, all the municipalities. It set out activities of low concern and high concern. So low concern, welcome to our town, Olympic torch run. High concern, company name, share the flame, 2-for-1 Olympic torch relay special. Not okay. The concerning one to us was Vanhock sending out this message that's saying a commercial company distributing samples of their products to spectators, or an equivalent concern, a local politician distributing pamphlets along the route would be of high concern. And up top under sampling, distribution of any propaganda or commercial products along the relay route is not permitted unless distributed by Vanhock or OTR sponsors. Agent provocateur, this is a shot from Montebello, which was a major protest related to trade issues. The two gentlemen who were on the ground were accused of being police officers. They were wearing balaclavas and carrying rocks. This photo shows that they were wearing the same boots as the arresting officers. So you see the boots of the arresting officers, and the boots of the people who were being arrested were the same boots. And then the Sûreté later admitted, the Sûreté de Quebec later admitted that they'd gone undercover in the protests around Montebello, and that actually these were officers of theirs who were carrying rocks and engaged in that kind of activity. I have some really fun footage of RCMP officers around Gustavson Lake. discussing their smear and misinformation campaigns that they were engaged in around the protesters who were occupying land as part of an Aboriginal sovereignty claim, which I won't get into. But the activities of police in provoking violent reaction from security forces to give them an opportunity to arrest protesters has been an issue that's been raised for a while. But the police are limited in what they can do by the criminal code. Section 25.1 of the criminal code says it gives peace officers the ability to commit crimes in the following situations in the course of an investigation of an offense, and if they're designated peace officers and if they believe that the act itself is going to be less serious than the crime that they're investigating. But they're not allowed to engage in activities they're even allowed to engage in activities that could result in loss of or serious damage to property, and directing people to engage in these kinds of activities, including their agents, as long as there's this proportionality analysis. The only limits on it are that and this is the provision that relates to a civilian who might engage in these kinds of activities at the direction of a police officer. They're also exempted from being convicted under the criminal code. But nothing in this section. The only limit is you can't intentionally or criminally negligently cause the death or bodily harm of another person, and you can't obstruct, pervert, or defeat the course of justice, and you can't sexually assault someone. So short of those, there is nothing that police officers are limited to in terms of the ability to break the law as agents provocateurs. Wrote a letter to CSIS and the ISU saying, hey, you guys, will you do us a favor and give us a couple guarantees? Will you guarantee that you won't cause bodily harm or death to any other person as a result of your undercover activities or encourage anyone to do that? Will you not infiltrate civil society groups and assume the leadership of those groups? Will you only infiltrate those groups that you believe are actually going to cause bodily harm to other people or serious property damage? Obviously, the response we got back, non-responsive from CSIS. Please be assured that CSIS works diligently to protect Canada's national security while respecting the rule of law, as well as the rights of citizens to lawful advocacy, protest, and dissent. The ISU responding, all intelligence activities of the ISU are, quote, conducted in conformity with Canadian law. In short, we're not going to give you any of those guarantees, which was very disappointing from our perspective that they wouldn't tell us, we won't assume the leadership of activist groups. We won't encourage people to engage in activity that could cause bodily harm or death. Instead, these sort of bald statements that they're going to follow the law.
That was David Eby talking last week on the University of British Columbia campus about upcoming legal issues related to the Olympics in Vancouver. We'd like to thank Don Paley and MediaCoop.ca for making that audio available. You're listening to Black Mask, this frequency of resistance on CKUW 95.9 FM.